Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and welcome to The Road to Now. Today's episode is really exciting for me. I'm a huge soccer fan, and as a lot of you know right now, the World Cup is going on. And so we figured it was a good time to go back and trace the history of this event of FIFA, which is the governing body for soccer, and kind of how soccer became this global phenomenon. By some estimates, over a billion people watched the 2014 World Cup Finals, which is insane. According to some perhaps inflated FIFA numbers, over 3 billion people, 3 billion people tuned in to watch at least a little bit of the last World Cup. And this is an event which has always captured my imagination. Just a beautiful game, people coming from all over the world to play against each other. And I'll tell you, it has a crazy history. For those of you guys who don't know about this, the organization FIFA has been mired in corruption charges for a very long time. Recently, a Department of Justice investigation went in and raided the offices in Switzerland and uncovered all this corruption, forced the president out. There was all these issues surrounding taking bribes, where the World Cup was going to be. And so I hope that you will listen to this episode and enjoy it, because it's as much a history of soccer as it is kind of the business of sports and what happens when this sport that the players love becomes mired in this international world of money and corruption and payouts. So this is a great episode, not only because of the topic, and of course I'm partial here, but because of our guests. And this made me so happy, because when I wanted to do an episode on the World Cup, two people popped into my head. One is my old friend, Dr. Alex Galarza, who we were graduate students together at Michigan State. He just recently finished his doctoral dissertation on the history of soccer in Argentina. He had a fellowship from FIFA. He's also a Fulbright scholar in Argentina. He's currently a postdoctoral fellow at Haverford College. And Alex is amazing. He knows his history inside and out. And the second person that I thought would be great for this episode, you probably know if you've listened to this podcast for a while. He is Matt Negrand, the man, the legend, and currently the title holder for most episodes on The Road to Now. This is his 7th episode. And he stood out to me because you may know Matt Negrand as producer of The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. We first met him, as you know, when he was writing it with all due respect on Bloomberg. But what a lot of you probably don't know, because we've never spoken about this on the podcast, Matt Negrand traveled the world and covered soccer as a freelance reporter. So he was publishing all these amazing pieces in the New York Times, the New Yorker, Sports Illustrated, and he went all over the place. So he not only loves the sport, he covered it from a journalist perspective. Fortunately, I asked Alex and Matt both, could they sit down together? They said yes, and we had this great conversation. And we go through it. We talk about the controversy surrounding the selection of Russia, particularly Qatar. The other news, which makes me so happy, that in 2026, the World Cup is going to be shared between the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and possibly a game in Nashville, which has really got me very excited. I guess the other exciting thing about that is... I guess we'll definitely qualify for that one, which if you're following the World Cup right now, you know that we are, the United States is not there, which is kind of sad for me. But I have the future, and I have the promise of a World Cup here. And we spoke about kind of these sweet stories that we all had about, like, what was it that we loved about soccer that got us into it. I spoke about living in Russia for 2 years. And for those of you who have been watching the World Cup, Luzhniki Stadium, where the opening match was held, and a lot of the matches are held, that was in my neighborhood in Moscow. And I used to go there and watch my favorite team, Spartak Moscow, Moskovsky Spartak, play there. And it was a wonderful experience. I still try to follow them, although it's not particularly easy in the United States. So we spoke a lot about that. And, you know, should every country be able to host the World Cup? We had some disagreement on that. But we'll let you enjoy this as we get to it. I also wanted to announce now that this is episode number 99 of The Road to Now. And that's 99 regular episodes. We've done Road to Now Theology episodes. We've done, you know, catching up episodes. We've done a lot more, actually. But officially, this is the number 99 episode. So what we're doing now is Bob and I are both getting ready to take off on some other projects this summer. You may know Bob's side project as the Avett Brothers. I don't know if you've heard about this band. They're really fantastic. He started a band with a couple of guys that I grew up with. Hired another friend of mine to kind of run the show on the road. Anyway, you should listen to them. Go to theavettbrothers.com and check them out. Really good band. But they've got a lot of shows coming up. They're recording. They're practicing. If you're listening to this right when it comes out, they will be this Wednesday night opening for Willie Nelson at the PNC Music Arena, Music Pavilion in Charlotte, North Carolina. And so well, we're going to take a couple weeks off. Bob's going to be out on the road, and I'm sure a lot of you who listen to this will be seeing him. And as you know, you will be seeing a good show. I myself am going to take a little time off, work on some writing that I've been working on. And also, I've been working a lot on comedy. And for anyone who wants to see my comedy, if you miss me while we take a break for about a month, I've got some cool shows coming up. If you're listening the first week this comes out, this Friday, June 22nd, I will be at the Ryman Auditorium as a panelist on Love It or Leave It, which is a great comedy podcast hosted by John Lovett, a former Obama staffer, part of the Pod Save America team there. And I'm really excited about that. And then on July 1st, I'll be taking off to Los Angeles, and I've got some shows out there. You can catch me at the Comedy Store on Saturday, July 14th. Come check that out. It's going to be a lot of fun. I've got a lot of other shows as well coming up. So you can find out about all that. SawyerComedy.com. That's my comedy website. All my dates are there. So if you miss us while we're off, you can find Bob or I on the road. We will be on the road a lot. And for those of you who support us on Patreon, don't worry. We're taking this off from the regular podcast, but we will still be recording episodes for you guys for the Patreon feed. So we'll be back in July. In the meantime, we hope that you have a fabulous summer. You enjoy your families. Somehow try to defeat this heat that those of you guys in the South are dealing with. But we thank you. Godspeed on the road. And enjoy our episode here on the World Cup in soccer.
Wraps round me like a blanket tight, gets inside your seat and kills.
Ramzor Records is pleased to announce the release of the Ruin Brothers debut album, All My Shades of Blue, produced by Rick Rubin. Download All My Shades of Blue on June 1st, or get your vinyl via Ramzor Records on June 22nd. Learn more by visiting RamzorRecords.com.
All right, guys, we're here, and the World Cup is currently in progress, and I've been wanting to do an episode for a while, and I had two people that I wanted to have on more than anybody, and I have those two people here with me today. The first is now the most repeat guest we've ever had, the most sought-after guest we've ever had. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back, long-time Road to Now regular Matt Negrin.
Whoa, take your seats, everybody. Come on. Just... down in your on your subway that you're listening to this on. Sit down if there's a seat open.
But not if there's an old lady sitting down. You should let her have the seat.
Oh, it's we're in like feminism 9.0 now. Everyone's equal on the subway.
Oh, damn. Well,
yeah. Who would know if you knew that?
There's a bastion of progressivism.
Yeah, I'm kicking off elderly people, pregnant people, handicapped people. Just all equivalent.
Well, that's Matt Negrin. And on the other hand, we have a first-time appearance. A really good friend of mine, a former co-graduate student at Michigan State University, and now an incredible digital historian. Welcome, Alex Galarza.
Great to be on the show. Been looking forward to this for a while.
He sounds convincing, guys. So, We hope you're as excited about him being here as he is about being here. Let's roll into this. It's the World Cup, and we have here – but I invited these guys because – as you know, Negrin from The Daily Show, from back in the day, with all due respect, but for a portion of his life, Matt Negrin traveled around the world and wrote about soccer. So he's got the journalism credentials. He's got the knowledge. On the other hand, my friend Alex Galarza is a former scholar funded by FIFA to do research, wrote his dissertation on soccer in Argentina, Fulbright scholar. So we have here kind of the best of both worlds. And so let's just get started on this. You guys have been watching the World Cup so far?
Every game, except for
absolutely,
except for the one that was too early for me this morning. So most of the games.
I missed the opener, which had 5 goals scored in it. So that was an unfortunate game to miss.
Yeah, three of those were like Putin-funded goals. So.
There's plenty of authoritarian-funded goals to talk about in the World Cup. So,
says the guy who was funded by FIFA to do his dissertation.
I took their dirty money and used it for good.
Change from within.
That's it. So yeah, I've been watching too. Let's not use the passive voice. 5 goals were scored. Russia scored 5 goals. And we all know that I live there. And many times sat in Luzhniki Stadium and watched Spartak Moscow play. So it's like it's my neighborhood back in Moscow.
Plus, when you play FIFA, you're always the Moscow team. So you've seen plenty of goals scored on your television and digital form.
Against me, because they put some reason Spartak Moscow lines up in the same division as like Real Madrid. Nah, not fair. So the World Cup is in Russia this year. It's been a big deal. There's been some criticism around that, and I think particularly in light of recent politics. What have you guys heard about that? Have you heard a lot of criticism? Has this been – you feel like it's been politically motivated, with especially with the whole Russia being in our headlines? Galarza, what do you think?
So there's been plenty of criticism, but it's taken a different form than last few World Cups that were hosted in Brazil and in South Africa. Mainly because a lot of things that grab headlines ahead of the World Cup are protests in the host nation. And so obviously the ability to protest the World Cup in Russia looks quite different than it does in Brazil and South Africa. So you haven't seen the same kinds of headlines, but there's been plenty of criticism, at least in the circles that I'm getting like some of my soccer news from, about obviously the cost, which is a recurring theme in World Cups, the amount of public money that's put into hosting an event that's always sold is something that will make money, but has been shown time and time again to never make money,
right,
and to lose plenty of public money. But then also because of human rights issues, especially a lot of the stories that I've been reading around the LGBTQ community. There was a story that I haven't gotten to read yet about a fan who was beaten for being gay during one of the fan events. So there's been plenty of criticism, and there's been plenty of stories about the potential negatives of Russia being the host. But it's, again, looked much different from, say, Brazil, where you had the military and the police going into poorer neighborhoods in the cities that were venues to drive people out to build the stadium in the first place, or to repress protest over the amount of state money that was being put into the tournament.
And I should add that Alex is currently in Guatemala. Is there a different view there than there is in the States?
Yeah, Guatemalans have a perspective from being a team that's never qualified for the World Cup, often at the expense or often at the hands of Mexico in a decisive fixture that didn't allow them to qualify. Yeah, it's different as a Latin American nation. Where soccer is the most popular sport, it's dominating all sports related headlines. Every office has, you know, a bracket fixture, and it's the main source of daily conversation as the tournament's going on, which is probably true in some spaces in the United States, but definitely not a nationwide phenomenon.
Right. Negrin, what's your take on this?
As thinking about what you said about Brazil and how it was different than, or how it's different than what's happening in Russia. When I was in Brazil for the World Cup, I lived with a family in one of the favelas that was swept out by the military police. And then I also lived separately. That was in Rio. And then I lived separately with a family in Brasilia with a family of
like feminist protesters who were anti-FIFA and anti-World Cup and anti-Brazil national team. And we went on a, I went with them to a protest on one day, and these people were very passionate. They were saying, you know, all the reasons you just said. Money is never spent for the hospitals and the schools that the government says. And then the protest ended 30 minutes before the game started, so all the protesters could go back and watch the game. Like, you can't separate soccer from them in Brazil. Even the most riled up protesters were like, "Well, I'm not going to miss the game. I mean, I got to get back to see if Brazil wins." I think it's almost comical that we're even talking about protesting, because as if it will ever matter. Like, FIFA is the most corrupt organization in the world. They gave the World Cup to Qatar, which has like no native population. They gave it to them because of a bribe. They've been importing slaves and killing them to build the World Cup. Like, I'm sorry, if there's not that doesn't even need a protest. Like, we shouldn't be participating in that World Cup. Nobody should be, but of course we're go, or if we qualify, we're going to. It drives so much money. There's no level of anger or rage that could ever stop any of these things from happening. So, I mean, protests in Russia are about Russia hosting the World Cup or about anything related to Russia's human rights record, almost seem, if not invisible, then so in vain, because there's no way they'll have like a lasting impact. Like, talking about the protests as much as we are about how many goals is Cristiano Ronaldo going to score.
Yeah, it's interesting because...
12, by the way.
Yeah, it's already been 3. The man's a machine. But it's interesting because I remember the discussion around Sochi with the Olympics there. And it was so dominated by kind of these two themes, which were, one, can they provide the security necessary to make it safe? Because it was further south, you know, closer to some of the regions where there's been conflict. And then the other one was, what's their human rights record? Isn't it bad? And I kept on telling people, if you don't care about human rights, which is largely the case, you don't have to worry about security. I mean, that's the issue. They would turn anybody away. But it was always interesting to me how it was like both of those were getting played out, because you know, the Western, or particularly the American view of Russia, is so negative. All the social media pictures of the unfinished hotel by people that clearly didn't remember that the Olympic Village during the Lake Placid Olympics was a federal prison that was being built and used for the village, and was immediately afterwards converted into a federal prison. I'm guessing, I mean, maybe the toilets were there. I don't know if there were walls or what. Just really interesting, you know, the whole view of Russia from there. So we just found out that we're getting this here. We're getting the World Cup in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Trump can kill NAFTA, but somehow the more corrupt organization of FIFA is going to bring us back together. Guys, what do you think about this?
I'm going to interrupt to just make this point. 3 consecutive World Cups will be hosted by Axis powers now: Russia, Qatar, and the United States. Disgusting. Okay. Now you can talk.
No, actually, let's go back to that. Qatar, because this is insane. I mean, not only is this a place that doesn't have any infrastructure, it doesn't have any soccer fan base, it barely has a population of native people. It's one of these countries where there's a very small group of oil elites that are very rich, with a population that has no buying power. They're building these stadiums there, and they announced they're moving the World Cup time from summer. After they got the bid, by the way, they said, we're going to do it in the summer. We're going to build all these stadiums with roofs and air conditioning. And then once they got it, they were like, psych, we're doing it during the winter. It's insane.
Yeah, people were dying building them. People would die playing soccer in 120 degree heat. I mean, there's no reason to there's no nuance. There's no mystery about why Qatar got the World Cup. They got it because they paid for it. But that's how it works.
So
it's not like we vote.
No, there's plenty of reporting on the FIFA scandals that demonstrate how much bribery and corruption was a part of the Qatar decision, including the assessments that FIFA does themselves to evaluate the bids and then rates them. Qatar was by far the worst bid at their own, by their own evaluation. So when the organization itself does its internal vetting and then picks the worst option, it doesn't leave much to doubt on how, you know, the executive committee would conceive of voting for the worst option.
And they had a chance. And they had a chance to mulligan when there was like this, there's like this weird like movement that like a couple years ago to be like, well, let's just take it away from Qatar and give it to the UK or the US, the only two countries that are prepared to host it on short notice, which even though it was like 6 years away at the time is still short notice, or it's 8 years, whatever. No, 6 years. Yeah. It was still short notice to like put it all together because we have all these stadiums. And FIFA was like, no, like we promised these people we would pay them.
Yeah. And ethical FIFA wouldn't want to break a promise, you know?
Yeah.
No, the Qatar decision, it's a fascinating one. And I recommend anyone interested in looking into it, the work of James Dorsey, who's a journalist who covers soccer in the Middle East. He would explain a little bit about the investment that Qatar sees in the World Cup as a foreign policy move. And is even as explicitly as a national defense move. It's a way to put itself on the map, and it's a way to actually invest vast sums of money that they're not sure what else to do with. Mm-hmm. And then also the work of Manu Vith, who's an expert on Russian soccer as well. And he's talked about how one of the most valuable currencies within FIFA is loyalty. And Putin showed his loyalty when this decision was questioned after the fall of Sepp Blatter because of corruption and bribery, and Infantino came in, and there was, like you were saying, Matt, there was an opportunity where it would have been understandable, and it perhaps would have even fit within, you know, FIFA's code of behavior to revisit that decision. But, you know, leaders like Putin and federations that were loyal to the people who made that decision would say this kind of discrediting of Russia and Qatar being selected as hosts is just a ploy by Western, you know, liberal democracies that see the World Cup as something that should be only hosted in places like Europe. So this is really they spun that into a story about the big guys trying to the big guys in soccer, right? Trying to beat down the little guys, because the World Cup should be shared, right? The World Cup should be for everyone.
Oh, these
not just places like
oil barons in Qatar wringing their hands over the fact that they haven't hosted an international soccer competition. It's all I wanted as a child. Not these 25 houses. I just wanted to host the World Cup for a month.
No, this like rolls into the question that I had, you know, the selection. It seems like because Sepp Blatter, I mean, in 2015, right? I mean, the United States Department of Justice, the Department of Justice of the country that cares the least about soccer, maybe in the world, led this raid on the offices in Zurich, uncovered all this corruption. Sepp Blatter, the previous president, was forced out, ostensibly banned from soccer, but Putin then invited him to come to the World Cup matches, which is the loyalty thing, right? So then they award it to the United States and Mexico and Canada, almost as a, you know, an attempt to say, well, maybe we should have before. Do you think this is like, because this is the question, it's now that Sepp Blatter and that raid has happened, is this a turning point? Are things better now, or is this just a
wow,
kind of
is FIFA funding you to ask this question, Ben?
If they did, they invested poorly, because the answer is no. No, things haven't changed. You know, this is on FIFA's watch. These are the highest ranking FIFA officials that are involved in these kinds of scandals. These recent ones in the Infantino era. The way in which Infantino has been able to reconsolidate power within the executive committee, despite opening up the selection process to all member nations. Before, it was just the executive committee that would pick. Now it's all member nations that can vote on these kinds of picks. But especially the pick for the United States, I don't think can be really seen as a, I don't think it could be fit within a narrative as a change for the better, because the United States is always going to be a place where FIFA sees its bottom line met. And that is the commercialization, the TV contracts, the thing that really drives FIFA World Cup revenue is only going to be, you know, successful in the United States. And it's a joint bid by the United States, Mexico, and Canada, but it will be held mostly in the United States. 60 of the 80 games will be hosted at U.S. stadiums, whereas 10 will be in Mexico and Canada.
I was going to say all the final game, like, right, aren't all the big games at the end are going to be here? Like, they're not going to be in Toronto.
Absolutely, yeah. After the group stage ends, it's all USA after that.
Yeah.
And those will be the stadiums that are best suited to generating TV revenue, and the timing will be, and the travel will be, you know, more conducive to the tournament.
I think FIFA's wet dream would be to have Americans love soccer more than any other sport, because our spending power and our economy would, and plus all the corruption that apparently we're fine with, like Scott Pruitt has a job still, which is nuts. Like we were clearly partners in, like we're on the same wavelength with FIFA corruption wise. If we cared as much about soccer as we did about football or basketball, FIFA would love it. They would have, I mean, look, you know what's interesting is look how many people buy the FIFA video game. It's very good. People like pay so much money for those games. They're very popular, even though soccer is like the fifth most popular sport in the US. Like FIFA's behind all that stuff. Their marketing is, I mean, it's very good. They have very good people pushing it down our throats.
Yeah, it seems like a good option. And how was the last time we had the World Cup here was 1994. How did that stack up? It made more money than the other ones? I mean, do you guys know that?
I don't know.
I don't have exact figures, but the 1994 World Cup was very successful commercially. But it was also it also fit within like a steady rising revenues for FIFA and how it administered the tournament and how it was able to really take its largest sponsors and put them at the heart of exclusive contracts that made it even more friendly. It made the World Cup even more attractive to sponsors because of the exclusivity and because of the you know, the TV time that those brands would get.
It's sad to me that none of the games will be played in actual soccer stadiums in the U.S. because we have some gorgeous soccer stadiums. Like the one in Kansas City is beautiful. Portland is like so cool. It's like this like half urban, half like nature oriented stadium. But and they're so small. They're like 20,000 seats because there's, you know, the fandom isn't really there to support a bigger stadium. But it's just, it's a cooler place to watch soccer. But for the World Cup, they're all going to be in football stadiums.
I will say that when Tottenham came to Nashville last summer and played Man City, they had the match at Titan Stadium, the whatever it's called now, LP Field or Nissan Stadium now, whatever, you know, the last one. It'll be called something different by the time the World Cup happens. It wasn't a bad place to watch soccer. I'll say that. I mean, not ideal. I mean, obviously, I'd rather be watching it in one of the smaller stadiums, but it wasn't terrible. It wasn't like going to watch college basketball at Ford Field.
Yeah.
So let's wrap up this portion of the show. I just want to ask you guys, you are obviously, I think you guys already answered this because you mocked this a minute ago. But do you think that any country should be able to host the World Cup? I mean, what's your take on this?
In an ideal world, yeah, absolutely. It'd be. I'll put it this way. In an ideal world, it would be great for countries that don't have the infrastructure ready for the World Cup to be able to host the tournaments. The question is, who pays for that infrastructure? Now, in a fairy tale world, FIFA would take its enormous revenues and the cost of hosting the tournament and take on a much bigger chunk of what it costs to host and to invest in infrastructure. And ideally, when host nations were selected for that process, they would have a system of public accountability around their spending on infrastructure and the tournament in general that would, let's say, skewed towards responsibility rather than just naked cash grabs and quizzically bad decisions around where bridges are put, where roads are put, how public infrastructure is set up. So that is in fairy tale land where there was more responsibility by host nations and more of a cost taken on by FIFA itself with all the revenues it gets from the World Cup. But the reality is that's not the model that the World Cup has had since, say, the mid-century. And there's no reason to expect that model is going to change in the near future. So it's going to do least harm in countries that are better prepared to host it, which is unfortunate because the 2030 World Cup would be awesome to have in Argentina and Uruguay. Now, Argentina and Uruguay was the first host of the World Cup in 1930, and the World Cup has a lot of historical roots in this Rio Platense region, this region of Uruguay and Argentina. it would, I think they actually stand a good chance of winning that bid, but it's going to be a disaster for both countries in terms of investment, in terms of infrastructure. Now, the unquantifiable joy that it'll bring, that's something that you can debate, but is it worth the cost that that will undoubtedly be borne by Argentines and Uruguayans who can't spare that? Then, yeah, it's a bummer to think that it's going to be bad no matter what.
I mean, ask Brazil. I don't think they are thrilled with what happened in 2014. Had they won, they would probably say, of course, we don't regret hosting it. But I think, I don't know the exact number, but one of the stadiums cost $1 billion and it only hosted four games. And then it was turned into a parking lot. So that's a waste of money. There was a stadium that was built in like one city that like doesn't even have like a soccer team. Like they're just like not, we have this idea that like everyone in Brazil loves soccer, but like it's actually not true. Some people don't. And this one place, like there's not a soccer team that could fill that stadium at all. So there was a huge boondoggle there and the government took a ton of the money away from the people. So on a humanitarian level, it was a mistake for sure. While the cup was happening, no one in Brazil thought that. They were all so like, it was like they were on some sort of like amazing drug where they couldn't be sad until Brazil lost. Neymar's face was everywhere. It was like, it felt like I was in North Korea and he was like the supreme leader. Like his face was all over the place. He was like the savior of Brazil. I don't know now how they feel. I bet there's a little bit of regret. But with, like we were talking about Qatar, yeah, like the Middle East is not good at soccer, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't have a chance to host it. But it shouldn't be Qatar. Like it shouldn't be the country that's like importing slaves to build it. There should be another way to do it. So in theory, it's great if everyone has a chance, but that just means that FIFA's more open to awarding countries that will bribe them the most. And there's no way to regulate that because they're an unregulatable government of their own. So I guess for corruption's sake, it would be easy if there were only like three World Cup countries that just rotate every 4 years, but that's obviously not fair. I don't know.
A lot of what would be more, easier to swallow about hosting a World Cup this is mainly by happenstance and FIFA deserves little to no credit for this, but the Women's World Cup is actually much more of a sustainable event. They host the next Women's World Cup is in 2019. It's going to be in France. Some of those games will be in smaller soccer specific stadiums. Many soccer stadiums are soccer specific in France, obviously, but it'll be at smaller venues. There will be obviously less of an outpouring of public funds for the event. So there's, there's a way in which there are some models that a World Cup could look like in the women's game. But again, it's FIFA deserves no credit for that. It's actually, in spite of FIFA's disservices and efforts to stifle the women's game, which is a long historical record on their part, that the Women's World Cup actually is probably more of an event like the one we're describing would be ideal.
La Cosecha Coffee Roasters provides fresh roasted coffee grown in a sustainable manner where the farmer is given a fair price, which means the coffee goes straight from the harvest to your cup. The best part? You can get 10% off your next purchase by using the promo code RTN1010 at checkout. Visit lacosecha.com or follow the links at theroadtonow.com.
I'm going to go on the record here and say that I think that there should only be a couple of teams that have the World Cup, and it's not a value judgment. It's a simple matter of sustainability, of, as you're talking about, human rights. There are countries that have the stadiums. The United States has the stadiums, right? We have the stadiums. France, has the capacity. Germany, Japan, probably China now. I don't think Russia's as far off as people think. I mean, the Soviet Union had a lot of stadiums. You know, the one thing they liked to do was build stadiums and put on parties, you know, and show the rest of the world that they were doing great.
Our gulags can host many people. You put them.
They even have workers' right built in there. You're making Stalin nostalgic right now, Negrin. But they, I mean, they've invested a lot in the soccer stadiums there. Spartak Moscow, my favorite team, has their own stadium now. A few years ago, they were all playing at Luzhniki Stadium, which was where the opening game was hosted and where the Olympics was hosted, where John Terry famously hit the post and lost the Champions League for Chelsea. All happened there. And, you know, personally, where I once got off of a subway at Sportivna, the stop there, with my mother and my godfather's friend, and we walked into a brawl between Spartak and CSKA fans. So, and I'm talking a brawl. Spartak fans were punching CSKA fans. CSKA fans were punching Spartak fans. Police were just randomly breaking people's heads. It was an amazing festival.
Well, the police have to divide on based on which team they're partial to also.
Well, they're probably all going CSKA because that's the Red Army team, you know? But
what if FIFA, if I were in charge of FIFA, you make it open to any country that wants to host it. And then you just pick a name at random, like you do like a lottery. Why do they have to vote? Like, isn't the voting what's tied to corruption? Because if you can bribe a voter, it's corrupt. But if you just pick a name out of like the, you know, when they do the group stage ping pong ball thing, just do that. And then, yeah, maybe New Zealand gets it one year.
Oh, no.
I'm not sure how well that would work.
Hey, I feel like we split the difference there. I feel like in only 24 minutes on a podcast, we solved the issue, guys.
That's it.
And Patino letter say, here's what's up, buddy. No, I mean, I understand where you're coming from, Ben. I disagree that the countries that are best suited to hosting the World Cup should be kind of the only ones that get it. The reasons are, you know, FIFA is an organization that, you know, with all of its corruption and with all of the scandal that we see recently, you know, you can take that far back into the 20th century, but it's also an organization that at points has democratized the global game. And it's come at an enormous cost in some ways, but it also has that as a kind of mandate. It does it very poorly, but sometimes it happens to do that anyway because of its corrupt ways. And so, you know, I'd point to South Africa, not only for its hosting of the World Cup, but also the way in which, you know, non-Western countries from the global South were able to, with the expansion of their membership in FIFA, displace the kind of hegemony of the European member nations by moving the World Cup around. It was really between South America and Europe for much of its history. And then South Africa was also a country that was able to lobby for change within FIFA because Sir Stanley Rouse, who was president for a while of the organization, was actively supporting the apartheid South African Football Association, SAFA. And it was because of the lobbying efforts of African member nations that they were able to, within FIFA, lobby for change by banning that apartheid football association. So South Africa was banned from competition in FIFA, largely because of the efforts of CAF nations. So there's moments in FIFA's history where you see the kind of, you know, the view of ownership by European countries that was guiding a lot of the decisions of FIFA, challenged by a lot of member nations that were outside of those countries that might be best suited to host it. Unfortunately, it just means that the way things work with the bid process is that countries are able to kind of impose their terms at the point of bidding. And then they are kind of, their leverage is over after that, right? So FIFA can lobby that nation to say, well, you got to give in to all these ridiculous demands around not paying taxes at all on our profits and setting up suspending your sovereignty over the areas where our stadiums are going to be located. And there's a way in which that theoretical empowerment by a host nation to say, well, no, we're not going to do that, looks very different in countries that don't have that infrastructure. So in an ideal world, it would rotate more, but it would just come with a different kind of ethics that inform the event. And unfortunately, FIFA is not really capable of doing that.
Yeah. So you're like, the South African story is a story of a racist regime that hated people of different colors, but loved soccer more than they hated people of different colors. That's a pretty sweet story there, Alex.
It's a story about other African nations lobbying within FIFA to ban the Racist Football Association.
Yeah. And didn't I read that Ghana's like leaving or something like this, and this is going on in Ghana right now?
Okay. I know Ghana was a place where a lot of the head of the Ghanaian Football Association was secretly filmed taking, I think, $120,000 bribe, which is not grounds to expel him from FIFA, but it is against their ethics code. So we'll wait to see what consequences there are for the head of the ANFA.
Say, if I were a referee on one of these games, I would 100% take a bribe to like throw a game or like make a call, whatever. Because if you're participating, because they're all FIFA refs, right? They're like FIFA approved. It's all under FIFA. If you're at any level in the FIFA organization, you have to assume everyone is getting paid off for something. Like even the chef for one of the teams is like getting paid off to like put like X-lax in the food or whatever. So like if you're not taking a bribe, you are at a disadvantage. Like you are not like squeezing the orange and getting the juice out of it. You know, you gotta step up. I'm just saying I would do it. I would do it for like $1,000 too.
This reminds me of, there's this Russian sketch comedy show called Nasha Russia. And, they have all these reoccurring characters. And one of the characters is, it's the Russian policeman who refused to take a bribe. and like it just cuts to him. He walks into his apartment, and there's no furniture in it. And his kids are like, his like whole family's emaciated, and he like walks in one time with like a huge McDonald's bag, and the kid looks so excited, and he's like, come to me, and the girl comes over, and he cuts two wormholes and a head hole in it, and puts it on, and it's her new dress. Like it's
yeah, being a member of FIFA who doesn't take a bribe is like winning the lottery and then throwing away the ticket. Like you hit the honeypot. You can get whatever you want from these people.
Oh, that's tragic. Well, let's go back then. Hey, you know, here we have this wonderfully horrible institution that we're all really excited about. And how funny is it that I've spent the last like 6 months being angry that my country doesn't get to participate in this horrible international organization? Let's go back though, all right? Because I want to get to where we are now. Alex, you're the historian here. How did the World Cup start? Where did it come from? And like, where do you see kind of the turn that brings in all this corruption? Was it always there, or is it something that kind of gradually comes in? Take us back.
So, FIFA was founded in Paris in 1904. It was the name of FIFA is the Fédération Internationale de Football Association. So I just put on my French accent at the end there and said the first part in a Spanish accent. I don't know why. But one of those founding members was a man named Jules Rimet. And Rimet would become president in 1921. And he was the first kind of longstanding FIFA president. And it's really in the post-World War I years that you see a tremendous expansion in international soccer competitions. There's been international soccer played since early after its founding in the mid 19th century, in the 1870s, the first time England played Scotland, making its way into the game and the way that money could be captured by FIFA and sponsorship and television deals and broadcasting deals.
So then it begins to spread around the world. So the first World Cup, there were only what? How many teams was?
Wasn't it like 16 or like 12? Like it was like a very small number.
Didn't
right?
the United States like make the third place or like make the semifinals or something in those?
Because all the good teams like weren't allowed to play or whatever. Like countries with good teams are not.
Yeah. 1950 in Brazil is where the United States exceeded expectations. But yeah, 1930 had a reduced, it had much fewer teams than we feature in the World Cup now.
I also like that, and I kind of wish we would go back to this, but they used to play the final over two games, and it was the cumulative score at the end of two games as opposed to one, which I just like. I, for some reason, I like that more. I don't know why. It's kind of it like adds like a level of drama to the second game.
Yeah, the World Cup's had a lot of different formats over the years. Sometimes it's been just a straight up round robin play, where you have an initial group stage where there's round robin play, and then everyone that's successful in those groups gets into a bigger pot, and then they play round robin again. And so those kinds of World Cups were really interesting because you got into some of the most compelling situations in soccer, where you have games going on that could impact another game, and so how many goals are going to be let in. In 1978, when Argentina hosts the World Cup, they needed to beat Peru by a difference of 5 goals, and they ended up beating them 6-1. This is a game that's shrouded in accusations of corruption. Henry Kissinger came down to the Peruvian dressing room with the Argentine dictator at the time and wished them luck. So yeah, there's been a lot of different formats for the competition, and that will have to happen again, because when it comes to the United States, Mexico, and Canada in 2026, there will be an expanded field of 48 teams. And so it'll be a similar kind of format in terms of a group and a knockout stage, but more teams will get out of the group.
One of the like culturally interesting things that I liked about the World Cup that I learned was like the culture sharing element early on, like before people had a way to really like experience other cultures casually, was in 1950 when Brazil hosted it. And I learned this in Croatia because I was staying with some supporters for one of the Croatian teams, and their supporters group is called Torcida. And Torcida is a Portuguese name for supporter. And their name came from, in 1950, a bunch of Croatians went to Brazil for the World Cup, and they weren't like, they didn't really know what fans were, I guess. Like, they were fans of Croatia, but they weren't like the rabid kind of fanatics. See, and then they saw Brazil, and they saw like what Brazil was doing, and they saw this like incredible and emotional, like, I guess, like kind of nationalist support for their team. And they were like, that's what we need to do. And they learned that they call themselves Torcida because that's just what, like, Brazilians were like, yeah, I'm Torcida. I'm a fan. I'm a supporter. So then they went back to Croatia and they were like, we're Torcida now. And that became the supporter group for a club team in Croatia. And I think that's it. And they're known, like, kind of not in a good way in Europe, as being a notoriously like violent supporters group, but it's also the oldest supporters group in Europe for football is Torcida. And they're wild, and they're like, they're very well organized now and like, and fun, but, you know, if you're on the right side of it, I guess.
Yeah. It's always fun if you're on the right side of it. Like whenever I would be at the Spartak Stadium, you know, at the matches, I originally was terrified because I was like, those guys are having a lot of fun. I'm a foreigner. This is not a particularly warm organization of foreigners. But later on, they kind of appreciated that I like Spartak and I like had a jersey. They love that.
That's the deal maker, is whether you support them or not. I think if it doesn't matter who you are, if you support the other team, that they'll kill you.
Yeah, that was like, I was going to ask you guys like what were your best stories about going to a soccer match? This is like a transition to mine. It was after I lived in Moscow for 2 years, and I would go see Spartak play. And it's kind of cool because these European clubs have histories to them that a lot of our American sports clubs don't have. For Russian soccer, during the Soviet era, and this is a great book by Bob Edelman on this about Spartak Moscow. Almost all of the soccer clubs in Russia and the Soviet Union were associated with some organization of the government. So like the Dynamo teams were the special police teams. Or no, not Dynamo. It was, so for example, CSKA, is which you guys may know is the basketball team that's really good, that sometimes comes over and plays American clubs. They have a basketball club, they have a soccer club, but the words that stands for is the Sporting Club of the Red Army. So it was affiliated with the Red Army. There were the clubs that were associated with the KGB. And Spartak was the only club that was big during the Soviet era that had no association with a government organization. So it was always known as kind of the people's team. And so, as Edelman argues, Spartak was this club that in a very, very powerful and very jealous of its power regime, you could pull for Spartak and essentially, he argues anyway, be saying, to hell with this government. We're supporting this team and it's something that's ours. So being a historian, having read that book, I picked up Spartak Moscow. I went to a bunch of the matches and people warned me. They said, do not sit in the supporter section. Buy the more expensive seat, sit in the middle of the area. Don't sit over there behind the goal because it's nuts. And I went to a couple matches, sat in the sparsely, you know, in Luzhniki Stadium where they would sell 15,000 seats in an 80,000 person arena. I'd sit in this one side and there'd be a speck of like the people that were dumb enough to come to watch a Spartak away match. But then there would be this amazing place where people were waving flags, setting each other on fire. Fireworks were going off. They were singing songs. The entire fan supporter section lined between the seats and the field, lined with military officers, with German shepherds and machine guns, just basically to keep them off the field. And I never sat there until one day I went to buy tickets and I was walking around looking for the box office. And I ran into this Russian guy, what they would call kind of a gopnik, which is like these dudes that hang out, you know, by the underpasses and listen to their iPhones really loud. Google Gopnik. It's a wonderful thing. Him and his wife. And I asked them, where's the box office? And they said, we're going to buy tickets. Are you a Spartak fan? I said, yeah. They said, all right, come with us. And they shut down alcohol sales in the entire region of the city where a sporting match is going on. You can't buy it at the stadium. You can't even buy it anywhere. Shut it down for like a couple hours before, a couple hours after. You can only buy it in restaurants because that's too expensive for most people. So we're walking with them. These guys got a giant bag just full of like not just beer, but this Russian alcoholic beverage called Jaguar, which contains alcohol, caffeine, and nicotine. It's real fun. And they're just pounding them. And we go to buy tickets and they say, buy tickets with us. And I say, where are you going to sit? And they say, we're going to sit in the supporter section where you should sit. And I said, I don't know, man. Like I've been told not to sit there. And he said, it's all right. You're with us. And I sat in the supporter section. It was amazing. But not before we all went out drinking pretty heavily before that. I just took him into the restaurant and me and my wife, Kelly, and all our friends were buying them beers. And they told us about the place they lived. And they said that they were hoping to move soon. And I said, oh, why? She said, we'll need more room because I'm pregnant. Holy crap. And I was like, what is this place that we're in? But aside from
this, baby's gonna come out a straight up soccer fanatic at the age of zero.
Yeah. And that was like a point where I was like, oh my god, we're still in Russia. But the warmth, man, like the warmth of all the fans. I mean, I speak Russian with a terrible accent. I didn't start studying Russian until I was like in my 20s. I've got a terrible accent, but they loved me, and it was so much fun, and we got to be there, and we didn't get set on fire, but there were fires, and it was just kind of this amazing experience of in a place where you are perennial an outsider, especially as an American, where the better your Russian gets, the more people accuse you of being a spy because they can't imagine why you'd speak it. It was like this amazing point of like camaraderie, and I always sat in the fan section after that, and it was cool. So that's probably my favorite Russia story. Our soccer story.
That's how you became part of the deep state.
What about you guys? What's your best story? You guys have both been all over the world following soccer. Negrin, what's your story, man?
I've obviously got a lot. Some like that. Some that are crazy, like in the supporter section. In Croatia, they shove boat flares up their ass to like sneak them into the stadium to throw them at police officers. There was, I stayed with a tribe in the Amazon, which was the only professional team in Brazil made up of indigenous players. And they, competed as a way to like fight prejudice and try to make their voice heard. That was cool. But the one that like I can never forget is because it was one that like I almost shouldn't have found because it was in Finland and like soccer doesn't really exist in Finland a lot. It's a basketball country. And like even at the most populated soccer games, it's like less than MLS. Like it's not really a big deal. And I found out about the story there about this team that was the best team in Finland. Like that, they still have the pyramid like every other league except for the U.S., where like the Premier League has the best teams. And then every year, the worst one gets demoted to the second tier, and then the best one in the second tier gets promoted, and whatever. And they have like eight different tiers. And so this is a story about like the best team in Finland, the championship team. Which was called in the city of Tampere, and they got expelled over allegations of match fixing and like money laundering by the Finnish Football Association. The allegations were never proven, and a lot, and like no one really knows what was going on, but nonetheless they were expelled. And the fans, like the hardcore supporters, of which there were maybe 300, like it was not a lot of people, 200 or 300, and the supporters for a few weeks were like, we don't know what to do, like our life is over. They had this, like, they were relatively new to soccer. They had just kind of found out from the Swedes how to be real supporters, and then they got really into it, and they spent like a few years like basically committing their life to this thing, and then their team is gone. So the day before you can register as a team, they decided, or I think, no, the day of, like the deadline was like at 5 p.m. or something. And at like 4 o'clock, they were like, the fans were like, we have to register as a team and we have to restart the team. But they obviously couldn't do it in the Premier League, so they had to go to the eighth division. And the eighth division in Finland is like, you're playing in a forest and there's no stands. There's no fans anywhere. It's just two teams. It's like a beer league. It's like two drunk teams. And so they registered, and they took the name of the team and they added a K at the end, because K stood for the Finnish word for supporter. So they became Tom UK, and they emailed like everyone, all the supporters, and they were like, listen, we don't have jerseys, but show up in a blue shirt and you can play. And they had like a few days notice, and they got like 40 or 50 people to show up, and they had like banners and flares like going. It's the only time that a team has ever at that level had like any fans at all, and they won. It was like a great game, and they won, and they made this like this promise that they wouldn't stop playing until they got back to the top, the Premier League. And they ended up winning that year, and so they get promoted to the seventh division, and then they won that year, so they got to the sixth. And then they won that year, and so they got to the fifth. And I went there for their home opener when they were in the fifth division. And so I stayed with these guys for like 2 weeks. I went to like all their supporter events. I met everyone. And I like lived the life of a weird Finnish football fanatic. And I learned like all this weird stuff about Finnish culture. And I was like, it was the only time I've done like interviews naked in a sauna with like multiple people. It's so enjoyable. And they won the home opener, and it was like this incredible thing, because for a fifth division league game, they played on like basically a high school soccer field with like a track around the outside. And there's on one side of the field, there's like bleachers, and there were maybe like 10 or 15 people there for the other team. And this team has like 200 people with like these huge banners, and they're like, every soccer team has chants. So they're chanting the entire game standing up. And like the other team, it must be like, I mean, they know about these guys now, but like, it's insane. These guys are like, 40, like they're just kind of like messing around, and they got these supporters like chanting and screaming and waving flares and whatever. It was the only time that I had this like cool connection to them. Because like I thought the story was so amazing. And so I ended up like writing about it for the New York Times, and they were so pumped that they were going to be in the New York Times. So they were like treating me like royalty. And so, and I was using them and they were using me. And like the day that the story was published was May Day, and like 13 Finnish publications picked up the story and like quoted me. And like, even though like none of them interviewed me, they were just like, New York Times reporter Matt Negrin wanted to come to Finland to write about like whatever. I was like, how do you know that? And it became this like really cool moment for the team and for me. And so I decided to join the team's supporters. And that's the only soccer team I've ever like felt a part of, because like growing up, I was never really into MLS. I never really like got attached to an international team or whatever. And so like that, I consider like that team my team. And now I think they're in the third division. which is really serious. So like they have to recruit other players now. So a lot of the people in the third division, they're either in the third or fourth division, but it's a lot of like former players who are either too old or like they retired, but they're like, no, I'll play for this team because they believe in them. And I think there's a lot of like angst against the Football Association. And they kind of want to like stick it to the man. So they have like a great cause. They have the people on their side. They're all like, they're such good, clean people too, which is wonderful. Like they're not violent. Although, I mean, they've been in like altercations, but it's nothing like Russia or Bosnia or whatever. Like it's fucking Finland. Like they're very polite. So yeah, that's my soccer story.
Nigger, and I was kind of hoping that story was going to end like, and today that team is called Manchester United.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I was there.
That's awesome. All right.
You'll never hear about this team. Like, even if they get to be the top team, like, you'll never hear about them. It's so irrelevant.
They're like the best soccer team in Finland. It's like when I get introduced on stage as the funniest history professor.
It's like, exactly the same.
Awesome. Galarza, what's your story, man?
I think my best story is just about the most collective joy I've ever witnessed. I'm, you know, not from Argentina. I was born in the States, immigrant parents from Spain and in Ecuador, but I did my dissertation work in Buenos Aires, and obviously, you know, was very thrilled by Argentina making it to the final of the 2014 World Cup. But it was a semifinal where Argentina played a not terribly exciting 0-0 draw in the regular 90 minutes of the game against Holland, and then no scoring in extra time. And so it came down to penalties, and Argentina won on penalties. And you just heard this tremendous eruption of noise when that last penalty was scored by Argentina. And, you know, everyone who I was with, which wasn't a terribly large group, all looked at each other and almost at the same time said, "We're going to the Obelisco," and the Obelisco is the central literal pillar of Buenos Aires. It's a large obelisk, and the entire city, you know, congregated in this tiny area in the center. And getting there was this amazing experience of just feeling like you were one with this huge crowd that was all going to the same place just to celebrate. You know, the excitement of the game was only building because everyone was going to go to this place to celebrate. And we got on the subway and I thought we were going to make the train explode. And Buenos Aires has a normal, you know, ridiculous amount of traffic at rush hour, you know, people packing in and being packed into trains. But this was an entirely different level above that, where people were floating on one another within the subways. It was definitely not safe. And you know, everyone was singing the same songs, going to the obelisk and, you know, banging on the windows and on the roof of the train. And you thought it was going to come off the rails. And we got there and you come out of the subway and it's just, you know, pandemonium, but joyful pandemonium. And yeah, I just spent probably 3 hours in this place where nobody wanted to go home. And it was just the semifinal, you know, it was just Argentina getting to the final, which unfortunately they lost, or else the final celebration would have been amazing. But that was just for getting to the final, you know, this whole city coming together to express joy. I think that's what makes soccer so, you know, so beautiful, is that even when it's on a small scale, you know, you're feeling that collective, you know, experience. That collective misery is often what sows the seed for that kind of collective joy. And that's just the most intense I've witnessed it, you know.
Do you know the song that the Argentines sang in Brazil? It was like, I don't know how good. I want you to
sing. Bad Moon Rising.
Okay, I need you to sing it because it's my favorite soccer chant. And sing it in Spanish, and then is it in Spanish? Yeah, it's in, yeah, and then translate it because I love the song so much.
I'm not gonna sing the whole thing because it's rather insulting, actually. And I have too many Brazilian like, friends, but it's a song set to the tune of Bad Moon, so it's Brasil, decime que se siente. Yeah. And so they're saying, Brazil, tell me how it feels to have your father at home, essentially, like you're the person who lords over you at home, because Brazil was hosts. And so Argentina was, you know, there's a rivalry between Argentina and Brazil that you know, often is just most expressed by ragging on each other. And in fact, the other time where I saw the obelisk most kind of like, you know, surrounded by people is when Brazil was eliminated 7-1 by Germany. I think Argentines got as much, maybe just below that same amount of joy from Brazil being knocked out. And when they lost the final, you're sure that Brazil celebrated that as well.
That's awesome. The other reason I love that song is because they mention Maradona, right?
Yes. Maradona's better than Pelé is one of the lines.
What does that mean?
Maradona is better than Pelé.
That's so it's so funny that like the song is just like a straight up diss track.
It's a diss track to set to Bad Moon Rising. You gotta love it.
Yeah, I remember.
They were singing that everywhere. They were all over Rio. All these Argentines like busted in or drove in or whatever. Some of them didn't even know how they were gonna get home. They're like, whatever, we'll just stay here or we'll walk, like whatever. And they would do this thing where they would take a 2-liter bottle of Coke and slice it in half and pour like alcohol in it, the Coke, and mix it. And so they were all, but they would just keep it in the liter. So they were just holding bottoms of Coke liters and drinking them all over the beach and singing this fucking song. And it was so beautiful. I like could not get it out of my head for like a year. And they were the only team that I saw that had a song like that. That wasn't like a song you sing in during the match. It was like a song you sing outside to piss people off.
I gotta say here that I'm glad we didn't open with what's our favorite stories, because I think anyone who wasn't interested in soccer at all would just have all their stereotypes fulfilled by the fact that Alex's greatest moment was a game or a match that ended in a tie at 0-0 and then went to overtime and was 0-0. All right, guys, it's been great having you, Alex Galarza, Matt Negrin. This has been amazing. I wish this could go forever, but I'm home in North Carolina and I gotta have dinner with the family and Godspeed to you guys. By the way, the World Cup's going on, and as of right now, the title for most appearances on Road to Now goes to Matt Negrin.
Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I feel like the Ronaldo of Road to Now.
That's it. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. The Road to Now is produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scotta. Today's music is by Paul DeFigley. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, and Linda Thamer. If you'd like to join us on Patreon and get extra content, go to roadtonow.com and click on support at the top of our page. Keep up with us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @road_2_now. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second, and a 5-star rating and a few kind words does a lot to help us get the word out. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Take care.
Osiris. This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.